my happy home to see what I could find out. I left my folk and friends with the aim to clear my mind out. Hit the roundy road, many kinds I've met there, many stories told me all of the way to get there. Ooh. So on and on I go, the seconds tick, the time out, there's so much left to know when I'm on.
Welcome to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling on KKRN 88.5 FM. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. Unspun tries to unravel the hype and illusions of corporate media through in-depth interviews with truth-tellers and advocates from around the world. Unspun brings you information you need to deal with the important issues of our time. We're streaming live on the internet. Go to kkrn.org and click on the listen button. Unspun is also a call-in show. We invite questions and comments from our listeners. Our number in the studio is 530-337-1885, 530-337-1885. You can also send me an email at unspun@kkrn.org. Well, today our guest is Andy Skuse. Andy Skuse is a retired geologist and geophysical consultant who has worked for many years in oil and gas exploration. He came to, quote, appreciate how much harder we will have to work to keep additional carbon out of the atmosphere and oceans. His career has been as an applied scientist, mostly in tectonics and structural geology. He makes no claim to be a climate scientist, yet his interests in climate change have led him to create a website on the subject. That's at http://critical-angle.net. He is a regular contributor at skepticalscience.com, where he recently published a couple of articles that caught my attention. These articles are entitled The Road to 2 Degrees Part 1, Feasible Emissions Pathways, Burying Our Carbon and Bioenergy, and Part 2, Are the Experts Being Candid About Our Chances? His articles deal with the scientific concepts involved with meeting the 2 degrees Celsius rise in global temperature goals set by the UN negotiators. Some of the information may be technically challenging for the average or above-average American, but I felt it important to bring to our listeners, so I want to welcome our guest, Andy Skuse. Welcome to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling.
Hi, Doug. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, thanks for coming on. We had a little some technical problems a little while ago. Hopefully that didn't go out over the air, but yeah, I think we're squared away now. It's great to have you on for a couple of reasons. First of all, because I think you're probably more of a generalist. A lot of times the scientists that I've had on before don't seem to be able to talk on a level where the general audience can appreciate what they're saying or even understand sometimes if it gets too technical. So we'll try to keep a little non-technical if we can. And so just to start off, I thought maybe I'd ask you a little bit about your own personal transition from an oil exploration geologist to a climate change advocate. Maybe you could tell our listeners, you know, real quickly how that transition happened, your evolution into from being a geologist working in the oil fields to somebody online that's talking to the problems of climate change.
Yeah, well, I worked for, as you noted earlier, I worked for more than 30 years in the oil and gas business, and it was a great career. I worked with some great people, and during that time I saw the oil and gas business transition quite dramatically in many ways towards a lot more sensitivity towards environmental matters. And you'd be surprised at the number of people who work in the oil and gas business who love the outdoors and are quite proud of the fact that the oil and gas business has made a lower impact on the environment. and still a long way to go, but you know, they've made a lot of progress on that. So I had a great career working on some really good scientific problems in the oil and gas business, but over the last 10 years or so, I've come to appreciate that there's one problem that just isn't going to go away, and that's the problem of the carbon dioxide and methane emissions in the atmosphere. And, you know, whether we like it or not, they're building up and building up. I think for me, a moment of epiphany, if you like, was looking at seeing the Keeling curve for the first time. To remind your audience what that is, it's a measure on a volcano in Hawaii of the amount of carbon dioxide in the air. And it goes up inexorably. There's a sawtooth pattern related to the seasons, but it just keeps going up and up. And it's gone up now by the amount of CO2 in the air has gone up by 40%. That's higher than it's been for hundreds of thousands of years. And we know that the CO2 is a key kind of thing that has helped determine the temperature. It was when we go in and out of the ice age, we see the change in CO2 that's really driving the temperature. So you put it up 40% over what it's been for hundreds of thousands of years, and you're going to get terrible consequences out of this if we don't rein it in soon. So I came to the realization that, you know, it doesn't matter how hard we try to keep a light footprint, as long as we're putting this CO2 in the air, we're gonna have a problem, and we have to address that. And unfortunately, the brutal mathematics of it is that most of the oil and gas and coal that we have in the ground has to stay there.
The COP21 is going on, as you know, and you've probably been following it like I have for the last couple of weeks. And most activists, I think, would agree with you wholeheartedly. It has to stay in the ground. And yet some of the modeling and some of the IPCC scenarios, I guess they're called, look a little strange to me, and I think to a lot of other scientists. And part of, by the way, let me tell our listeners that there's several good places that I found that had COP21 coverage, and one of them was Amy Goodman on Democracy Now!, and the other was The Guardian newspaper online in the UK. And my other last week's guest, Paul Beckwith's site, paulbeckwith.net, he's been running an ongoing from the COP21 blog there, so it's very interesting. He's had some actually exclusive footage of some of the scientists and the negotiators there, so that's another interesting site you can go to. But the one that was interesting to me, and I know it was to you because it involved Kevin Anderson, who is, I think, director our deputy director of the Tyndall Climate Labs in the UK somewhere. I might not have his title exactly right. But he was interviewed on Amy Goodman's show. I think it was earlier this week. I'm not sure the date exactly. But I wanted to play that for our listeners. And we can kind of take off from there. Because he talks about these climate models and what they consist of, and then maybe you and I, Andy, can kind of clarify what these things actually mean, or as you were talking in your article about what those climate models look like. So I'm going to play this. Here we go.
We're broadcasting from the UN Climate Summit, the COP21 here in Paris, France. Ahead of the talks, more than 180 nations pledged to voluntarily reduce greenhouse gas emissions. But many climate justice groups say far more needs to be done to keep global warming in check. We're joined now by one of the world's leading climate scientists who's come to the Paris talks with a shocking message. The climate crisis is more severe than even many scientists have acknowledged. Kevin Anderson is deputy director of the Tyndall Center for Climate Change Research and professor of energy and climate change at the University of Manchester in Britain. He said many scientists are self-censoring their own work to downplay the severity of the climate crisis. Dr. Anderson recently wrote, quote, "Yet so far, we simply have not been prepared to accept the revolutionary implications of our own findings. And even when Dewey are reluctant to voice such thoughts openly. Many are ultimately choosing to censor their own research. Kevin Anderson, welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us.
It's nice to be here.
You came in from Britain?
Yes, I did.
How
did
you get here?
By train. I always travel by train or ship.
I remember when we were in Copenhagen, you refused to fly.
Yeah, I haven't flown for 11 years. Yeah.
Why?
Because I think it's really important that those of us who think climate change is an essential pivotal issue for modern society demonstrate that we can lead good lives, we can carry out our jobs without having very high carbon footprints. So whilst the emissions from my particular activities aren't quite so important, I'm just one person, the sort of symbolic message that it sends is actually very important. And it's already sort of engendered a different attitude amongst some other academic colleagues who now also take the similar approach. They try to avoid flying wherever they reasonably can. And sometimes that can make things quite difficult, but we have to make those efforts. That sort of effort.
So why are you here?
I'm here because there's a very important scientific message still to be made and to be relayed to not just the policymakers and the people here, but also to wider society, to the civil society groups, to the NGOs, but even, of course, for us to discuss amongst the scientists that are here as well.
And what is that message?
The message is that the voluntary submissions that have been put forward by all of the countries, when you add all of these up, they are far, far above the level of what we call dangerous climate change that all of our leaders have committed to avoid going above this 2 degrees C rise, think about 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit. But actually, when you add up all of the commitments that the countries are making in terms of their reductions in emissions, then actually it's far, far above that, nearer 3 or 4 degrees C temperature rise, which is a huge increase. That's a global average. Remember, that is a global average. And most of the globe is covered in water. So on land, that's an average of if we carry on like we're going now, 4, 5, possibly even as high as 6 degrees C temperature rise.
So what does that look like on the ground?
If we saw those sorts of changes, we'd see dramatic reductions in the staple food crops. So that's a really big issue. You know, big 40% or so reductions in rice, maize, wheat, sorghum, those sorts of crops. Huge changes in sea level rise by the end of the century, but also locking in very large sea level rise changes going forward beyond that. We'd see increase in droughts and in flooding, increase in severity of typhoons in the southern hemisphere. So really, a lot of we've all learned to live with the weather that we've had. And actually what we'd be seeing are significant increases in the extremes around the planet. So we'd all suffer very significantly from a 4 degrees C temperature rise.
You have said that scientists, climate scientists, are self-censoring. What are they saying?
Well, those of us who look at the running between the science and then translating that into what that means for policymakers, what we are afraid of doing is putting forward analysis that questions the sort of economic paradigm, the economic way that we run society today. So we think, actually, we daren't question that. So what we do is we fine-tune our analysis so it fits within a sort of the political and economic framing of society, the current political and economic framing. So we daren't really say that actually our science now asks fundamental questions about this idea of economic growth in the short term. And we're very reluctant to say that. In fact, the funding bodies often are reluctant to fund research that raises those questions. So the whole setup, not just the science, the research community around it that funds the research, the journalists, events like this, we're all deliberately being slightly sort of self-delusional. We all know the situation is much more severe than we're prepared to voice openly, and we all know this.
Well, that's Kevin Anderson on Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman a few days ago, and he also wrote an article, Duality in Climate Science, which our guest Andy Skous is featured in his article. So I want to go back to you, Andy. This was striking to me that a well-respected climate researcher has come out and basically said that the climate change research community is kind of fudging.
Well, I don't know whether he's saying they're fudging, but I think he's saying that they're basically trying not to rock the boat too much because of their governments and their research agencies that are funding them, you know, often have this beam underwritten that science should be the sort of servant of economic growth and so on. So when you come to conclusions like Kevin Anderson has come to, basically it requires that we do some quite radical stuff with our economic models here. So and he doesn't think that that's been given enough consideration, particularly. I mean, we have to reduce even to meet the 2 degree target. And you may have heard that the Paris meetings they've now adopted at least as an aspiration, one and a half degree target. Now, the 2 degree target is a really hard target to meet, but one and a half degrees is actually twice as hard to get to, because the carbon budget that we have to get there is about half. We're at 1 degree already, so a carbon budget for 1.5 degrees is half of what we have for 2 degrees. And 2 degrees was already pretty slim, and we're going to use that up quite quickly for 20 years or so. So to get to 2 degrees, we have to reduce our emissions by 10% a year. And that's if there's no economic growth. And if there's economic growth, say 3%, then we have to go to 13%. Now, all the economists say that 4% per year in decarbonization is about all they can imagine us doing. We don't have to believe the economists all the time, but still, there's a big gulf there between what one field of experts is saying we have to do and what another field of experts is saying we have to do, and that clash of opinion, I think, is not given due attention. I think that's maybe Kevin Anderson's main point. But to get to 1.5 degrees, the climate scientist Miles Allen has just pointed out, we need to reduce by 20% a year. So that 1.5 degree target that's now in the agreement as an aspiration requires really, really, really dramatic changes to the way we run our economy.
Let me break in here for a second and remind our listeners, you're listening to Unspun on Experiment and Truth Telling. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. With us today is Andy Skuse, Canadian geologist and climate change blogger on skepticalscience.com's website. And we're discussing climate science, of course, with a view on what the current science tells us about the COP21 agreements and those goals and what that portends for us as human beings. You can call in and ask Andy some questions if you'd like. The number here in the studio is 530-337-1885, 530-337-1885. Well, Andy, yeah, the point, we have these aspirations, or as I heard some, they were using the term ambitions and ambitious, this COP, which I hadn't heard so much before on other COPs in the past. So, but none of these things are non-binding, and as you say, there's a huge discrepancy between what science tells us, which means science tells us we have to act now, and we have to act meaningfully and deliberately to, as you predict, about a 10% cut in emissions every year. And unfortunately, the economic and social paradigms that we exist under right now, I can't see that happening. And we've seen these COPs before. They go by no binding agreements. We have these pledges, and maybe you can talk to those pledges that the different countries are making now. But a lot of climate activists say they're insufficient, and they're not going to work because there's no enforcement of any of these pledges.
Yeah, I don't think it's a question just of enforcement, but the actual pledges themselves, as Kevin Anderson described them, also fall short. And even in the text of the agreement, there's an acknowledgement that the pledges aren't going to get us to where we need to be, even to the 2 degree target. They're only going to take us even part of the way there. So, and the pledges mostly go up to the year 2030, and most of our climate projections conventionally go to the end of this century. So there's a lot of work to be done between 2030 and the end of the century. Everybody acknowledges, even in the Paris Agreement, the pledges are completely insufficient for this. And what the term they use is ratcheting. So every 5 years they want to revisit the pledges and the progress people have made, and continue tightening the pledges and commitments, and see where we're going. So this has been a bone of contention, I understand, in the talks, how they're going to do this and how transparent that's going to be. So yes, we need to do a lot more. So there are a lot of steps that need to be made after Paris. I think the Paris Agreement is a wonderful thing. It could well prove to be the turning point in terms of mitigation, to get unanimous worldwide support that we need to aim as low as possible for the amount of warming we're going to get. And countries have made these pledges. I mean, we may say that they're insufficient, but for a lot of countries, even to achieve their own pledges is going to require big disruptions. For example, in my country, Canada, to get to their pledge, which is 30% below the 2005 emissions by 2030, in just 25 years, just 15 years from now, that's going to require a gigantic amount of reduction. And basically, it's going to create big regional problems because they're going to have to, the biggest growing source of CO2 in Canada is the bitumen mining operations in Alberta. So it's going to be hugely difficult to get there and politically challenging, even for those pledges. And to reiterate, those pledges are not enough. So this is a turning point, but it's by no means the answer yet.
Well, I think we have a caller. I'm not sure. I see that a line's busy here. Yeah, we do. I'm going to bring our caller on the air and hear what he has to say. Andy, you're on the air.
Sorry,
Randy, you're on the air.
Oh, okay.
And Andy's on the air, too.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, anyway, you know, I have this experience of talking climate change locally, and there are, handfuls of individuals, and they might be more than that, who just adamantly reject climate science, and they will not look at it. They just flat out deny it exists. And they refuse to look at it, and they're considered in any way, and it's incredible that intelligent people will do that. But I'm just curious: is this problem? I mean, does it go beyond the U.S. or is this mainly this determined ignorance? Is it mainly a problem in the U.S.? What do you observe out in the world in regards to the population accepting scientific realities of climate change? Thank you.
Thanks for the question.
Okay. I think the issue of climate denialism, if that's what you want to call it, is probably more acute in the U.S., and it's certainly the distinguishing thing about the U.S. is that you've got a major political party that denies the climate science. That doesn't exist anywhere else in the world. Even conservative parties in Europe, even in Canada, at least pay lip service to the science of climate change, even if they're reluctant foot draggers when it comes to reducing emissions. But so the U.S. is kind of unique that way. But there are people who reject it everywhere, and it's become a marker of a certain tribal loyalty to say that you reject this. And to be honest, it's difficult to confront these people because they won't listen to the facts and the reasoning. Probably the best way is to demonstrate the changes that are happening locally. You know, you see pine beetles, or you see spring coming sooner, that kind of thing. You see sea level rising. You see other changes that are local and that people can't deny. So, it's a terrible problem. It's probably worse in the U.S. because of the political parties. In the U.S., the Republican Party in particular. But it's a problem that's everywhere to some degree.
Yeah, you and I had talked about this before the show, and my approach going forward is I'm not going to waste any time on it. The science is in. We know what it is. It's man-made, man-caused, global warming. The facts are in. Discussion over. So, I don't want to waste any more time on climate science denial and global warming denial because it's just not productive. But coming back,
I can just add to that. You know, I helped write a paper where we showed that 97% of all the scientific papers that expressed an opinion on climate science, you know, basically endorsed the IPCC position, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate, that man-made warming is real. And you see all these thousands of people working away at the UN, tens of thousands, actually, from all over the world, from different walks of life. And they don't need any convincing that it's real and it's a problem. So, you know, we pay far too much attention, I think, to what's a fringe group, albeit it's a fringe group with a lot of political clout in the United States.
And that's something we'll deal with, I'm sure, in the near future, because I don't feel we have very much time to fool around on a political level at all. And I think most climate activists understand that they just have to keep pushing because it's too critical. It's a critical time. We don't have we've wasted how many years? This is COP21, just ended 21 years or 23 years or whatever it's been since the IPCC has been set up. You know, we just don't have the time. But in coming back to our discussion, because I think this is what Kevin Anderson was alluding to also, is that some scientists are downplaying the threat, underestimating it. Many are not, of course, looking at these tipping points that some of the other scientists, like methane releases in the Arctic and the peat bogs thawing out and these other, you know, ice loss in the Arctic. These are things that are positive feedback loops, and we didn't talk about this, and your article didn't talk about it too much, but you brought it up earlier. Do we really have as much time as we think? Because some of these other positive feedbacks could cut our time very short.
Yeah, I've written on that subject as well, and there's a number of things that even on a low warming pathway, maybe as much as one quarter of the emissions could now come from natural sources, either emissions from natural sources like melting permafrost or the peat that you talked about, which, you know, it's like taking a whole bunch of frozen vegetables out of your freezer and putting them on your kitchen counter, and then they just rot away. So that's happening already. That's underway, and that could add, you know, several years worth of worldwide fossil fuel emissions, just like that. And there's nothing we can do to stop that, really. I don't think, apart from geoengineering, but that's off the table as far as I'm concerned for the time being. But then there's also, you know, changes in the tropical forests. There's signs that the tropical forests are dying off more quickly than we thought. So a lot of these things are in the model, ought to be in the models that the IPCC is using, but they're not. And there's what Kevin Anderson argues is that there's a kind of double bias in the IPCC in that they neglect to include some of these changes because they're still not very well quantified, whereas the models that they use for the decarbonization, they're happy to use technologies that are also highly speculative. So on one hand, they've got an optimistic bias on how bad it could be. There's a downplaying the risk by not putting in these so-called carbon cycle feedbacks. But on the other hand, they're downplaying the difficulty of dealing with emissions by postulating things like bioenergy, carbon capture and storage, which probably we should talk about a bit more.
Yeah, I'd like to talk to that because I was looking at those graphs on your website just now again, and it looks like we want to double our energy usage and using some pretty questionable, what did you call them, BECCS? Bioengineering, carbon?
Bioenergy, carbon capture and storage. Basically,
yeah.
What it is burning stuff like wood in a furnace and using that to generate electricity and then capturing the carbon dioxide that comes off. And then piping it to somewhere where you can put it underground. So we can get into more detail about the technology there. But it's the elements of this technology are all there. There are bioenergy plants around, and there's some demonstration carbon capture and storage plants. So it's not so much that the technology is unproven, but that it's unproven at the scale that we need it at, and how quickly we need to roll it out. And as you say, the models show a doubling in energy use, and you know, a lot of that is inevitable. I mean, at the moment, 10% of the population of the world uses 50% of the energy, and 50%, the poorest 50%, use only 10%. So those people are going to get richer. At least we should hope that they get richer, and they're going to want to use more energy. They're going to need energy for refrigerators and fans and cook stoves and all that kind of stuff that's going to improve their lives immensely and rise to a sort of global middle class standard. And they're going to need more energy. And it's a question of how we provide that energy is the key thing, and how we deal with those of us who live in the 10%, because we're all, most people listening to your show are going to be in the 10% of the people who use 50% of the energy. So we have two problems. We have to rein back our own energy use at the same time as providing increased energy, increased clean energy for the half of the world who doesn't have any, basically. So this is a huge problem.
Yeah, besides that's what we're calling climate injustice, and this is where there's another disconnect between the climate research side of the science and the biological side of the science, is we're in the sixth great extinction. We don't have time to be building more coal-fired power plants. We just can't. Our system is not going to tolerate it. And some of these other things, like the biomass, which we have here in where we live. We have a large lumber company. It's actually owned by a private person, one of the richest people in the United States. He owns millions of acres, him and his family, and they run the logging industry in a great part of Northern California. And they clear cut, and if they don't turn it into lumber, they burn it. They have their own biomass mills that churn out huge amounts of polluted carbon dioxide and other pollutants. And everybody thinks this is just a wonderful trade-off. I just don't get it, because it doesn't make sense. And, in fact, I think you talked to another article. I want to say it was called Pulp Fiction. That deals with this problem. And maybe you could tell us a little bit more about that, because I know some of the people listening, we live out in the forests. We understand what's going on out here, and it's not a very good trade-off.
Yeah, I mean, I live in a forest too, and we have a wood stove, and a good wood stove that doesn't put out much black carbon and that kind of thing. But and we burn mostly waste wood, timber that couldn't be used for any other purpose. And it sounds like in your area that's what happens as well, also on an industrial scale. So, you know, that's not too bad in terms of the pollution effects, carbon pollution effects. There's other problems with, as you mentioned. But what's happening in the United Kingdom, for example, is that they have Drax, which is a big power station. They're converting it from coal to wood chips. And they get most of their wood chips from the United States and Canada. Now, it seems kind of crazy to be transporting by ship these wood chips all the way through the Panama Canal or across the Atlantic Ocean to Yorkshire and England to burn. Part of the reason they're doing this is because it's deemed as carbon free, carbon neutral, whereas it isn't really, because it seems that a lot of the wood that's being used for that is actually what they call round wood. So it's basically healthy trees that are being harvested to be made into chips, to be transported across the Atlantic, to be burned in England. So this isn't a carbon-free thing. This has got significant emissions, because that carbon was well locked up in those trees, and now it's not, and it's not coming back for decades. You know, you replant the forest, but it takes a long time before they start growing quickly again. So there's a bit of a fiction. That's why I think John Upton called his series of articles Pulp Fiction, because it's not carbon free, it's not carbon neutral at all. It actually emits quite a bit of carbon, and it's a problem. And it's only the accountants who consider it to be carbon neutral. Really, the atmosphere doesn't.
Well, even the
so
fact
this is a problem. And yeah. this is the kind of problem. If we start relying on bioenergy, carbon capture and storage, this is a problem that's going to get much worse.
And part of the scenarios that we talked about, quite a few of them, involve these kind of what you call CCS, carbon capture schemes or sequestration? I like carbon capture schemes better. As you said, they're not scalable. And to cut down mature forests with trees that are 200 years old that are busy converting carbon to oxygen and you know other usable and carbon storage, you know, is to me it's just crazy, and that we allow it. This is the part that gets me, that our governments, our state government, I know people that have been down to the California state capitol and challenged these procedures, you know, corporations or previous corporate executives are sitting on the same boards that are regulating them. And so we, it just doesn't make any sense. It's completely upside down. The other one you talked about was the sequestration problems. We're talking about huge amounts. What was the estimate I think you gave in the article? For every pound of household trash, the average person is producing 40 pounds of carbon dioxide.
Yeah, that's roughly the figure for the United States. So every time you take your every week when you take when you wheel your trash to the curb to be picked up, you imagine that probably for the average American or Canadian that you can take that weight and multiply it 40 times, and that's really what our per-person emissions are. So we just came up with that number. It wasn't me who came up with that. The first person I heard was the climate scientist Richard Alley, who mentioned that. But it gives a good visualization of the scale of our emissions problem. We all know that, you know, we produce a lot of trash, and it's expensive and difficult to get rid of, and communities all over the world have a hard time finding spots for their landfills. So basically, the sequestration problem is also going to be we have to put this stuff in the ground somewhere, and where, so we can do a bit of it. There's some pilot plants going on around the world, in Norway, Algeria, and in Canada, in the United States, that are, you know, they found good locations where they can dispose of carbon dioxide safely, they think, and so on. But you know, these are quite small plants, and they get rid of, you know, on average about 2 million tons a year, and I think there's something like 14 of those operating all around the world at the moment. But to deal with the scale that some of these 2-degree climate models say, we're going to need something like 20,000 of those over the next 30 years or so. So that's gigantic. I mean,
yeah. And who pays for that?
Well,
yeah. How does that happen?
Newsflash: you will. We will. because it's the end users of the energy who will eventually have to pay for it. The cost of that is going to be about, well, it could be, and nobody knows how much it's going to cost. It's going to be $50 to $100 U.S. dollars per ton of CO2. So, if we have a carbon tax that was at $100 a ton, then you could pay people out of their carbon tax for putting that in the ground, and it could potentially make money. But since we don't now have a carbon tax in most parts of the world, and nowhere do we have a carbon tax sufficient to sustain the sequestration business, there's no business model for it. So at the moment, it's being paid for by government grants.
And it's even, I did read that little, you had a link to those sequestration projects, and there was one up near you, and not really close to you, but you're in Canada, and it's in Canada. So, by the tar sands, and what you're calling bitumen deposits, which is really dirty and cost-intensive and energy-intensive process, and they have one of those plants there. Well, it was only able to capture and sequester 1 million tons of carbon dioxide. But the plant itself, and I'm sure this is an underestimation, I would be willing to bet, was using over 70 or producing over 70 million tons of carbon dioxide.
Not the plant. The whole industry, the whole tar sands industry, produces in the so-called upstream. So what actually comes into the air in Alberta produces about 70 million tons per year.
Yeah. But just, your point was, though, to be carbon neutral, you would have to have 70 of those plants.
Exactly, yeah. So, you know, and things like wind and solar power, as you develop them, they get cheaper and cheaper as you learn from scaling them up. The more you make, the cheaper ways you find of building these things and installing them and tying them into the grid. So there's a nice virtuous circle with these things. But with projects like carbon capture and storage, you often pick the best sites first, and so it could be that the initial, I think in Alberta they reckon that it's going to cost them about $70 a ton to dispose of this stuff over the lifetime. And I should add that that particular plant has only just started, so we don't know if it's going to have problems or whatever. A lot of these things really are demonstration plants, so they're done as a science project to see what happens when we do this. But, these have been carefully selected as, ideal places, far away from people. They found a reservoir for it that's well-protected from groundwater and all the rest of it and the population. But there are not that many places around the world where you have both the source of carbon dioxide and the means to dispose of it that you can do with public acceptance and geological safety at all. So it's going to become more and more expensive as you go along rather than cheaper. So the sort of normal deployment scaling laws aren't going to apply to carbon capture and storage in the same way that they do, say, to wind or solar power.
Well, and then if you add that cost to the extraction of that dirty oil, the conversion, I guess it would actually be, of that dirty oil and then transporting it somewhere where somebody wants to refine it, it becomes ridiculous. And this goes back to the point that James Hansen made, the same point about having a carbon fee. The other, what was his name? Kevin. Yeah, Kevin Anderson made the point that these technologies and these sources of dirty fuel, which we need to leave in the ground anyway, the idea that you can make them clean somehow, like clean coal and clean oil, these are fictions in my mind. And I think, what did Kevin Anderson say? I had it written down, but he basically said to make these goals, you'd have to have a time machine.
I think what he was referring to there was that a lot of the models that people are relying on showed a decline in global emissions that started in 2010. And that actually hasn't happened. I mean, we're seeing a little bit of a dip now, but we're not going to know whether this current dip in global emissions or flatlining is going to be a real turning point, or whether it's just a little stair step on the way up to continuing growing emissions. We won't know that until we have a good rearview mirror of 5 or 10 years or so of declining emissions. But as Kevin pointed out, the model say 2010. So that's where the time machine came. It's like we go back and rewrite history.
We can fix it in the time machine.
Yeah.
Well, and the other point is, I saw an article. There's been a lot of this upplay of green growth, which I think is a lie. I think we're going to find out the hard way if we don't start reducing emissions drastically right now. No excuses. Just stop pulling them out of the ground and go to real renewables, like you were talking about, wind and sun and tidal. And we have all kinds of ways to generate energy that's a lot cleaner. And like you were saying, the scale and the dangerous ideas of the sequestration to me are just, it's just crazy. It's not going to happen. We're looking at the world economically. Even the economic powers are all suffering. The countries are going through austerity. There's no money for this, and they're not going to allot money for this. They'd rather go and bomb people. So, we are psychotic in the sense that we're not able to see the reality. We're living in some other reality. That's the way I feel about it. Let me remind our listeners one more time. You're listening to Unspun, an Experiment in Truth Telling. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. With us today is Andy Skous, Canadian geologist and climate change blogger on Skeptical Science. We're talking about climate science, COP21, our own survival under some of the scenarios that the IPCC is talking about. You can call in. The number is 530-337-1885. 530-337-1885. Yeah, the problem I see is besides the lack of political will to be treating the sixth great extinction and global warming like a political football, which people are doing in the United States, just entirely misses the point.
Yes. Now, I would perhaps not be as strong as you were on dismissing carbon capture and storage or sequestration or whatever you called it as a fantasy. I think it can actually work a little bit. The analogy I'd make is a couple of American researchers, Pacolo and somebody else, I can't remember his name, wrote a paper years ago about all these wedges that we need. So they identified 15 or 30 wedges of different technologies that we need to get the problem under control. I think 15 to get emissions to be flat and 30 or more to get them down to zero, which is really where they need to be. And I think, you know, carbon capture and storage could perhaps provide one of those wedges. My criticism of the models is that they claim that carbon capture and storage can basically be all of these wedges, and I don't see that as realistic at all. And it's the same with bioenergy. I think it's fine. I think bioenergy will play a role. There'll be some role for biofuels. We can get the emissions thing right, and we can locally burn waste wood in clean burners and so on, and that can help us heat our homes and provide electricity locally in places that are blessed with forests. But we just can't rely on it being a big source of industrial energy in parts of the world where there are no forests. They can't import this stuff to all the way to England. That's what's crazy. It's not so much the principle of the industries, but it's the scale that's the fantasy.
Yeah, I would agree. And but there are people looking for, like, Paul Ehrlich. I had him on a couple of months ago, and he co-wrote a new paper along with, I forget, 10 or 12 other people. And looking at real solutions over that same period of time, this next 80 years, you could have population down to a realistic, you know, sustainable level. We're going towards 8 billion people now, 7.5 or wherever we are as far as population. We know every person you add somehow adds to the climate change, the bill, you know, the bill's going to come due pretty soon. And we don't seem to be looking at those alternatives. We don't want to look at the workable paradigm, which is to get those 10% to stop consuming, start, you know, sharing the wealth, build a better world. We're not making those changes. And I guess that's why I'm so skeptical, because I'm looking at what's going on in the world and how these large corporations seem to be controlling everything, all the policy, certainly in the United States. You know, we're supposed to be a leader. I saw that James Hansen came out and said China might be the leader because they don't have to deal with climate deniers in their government. So what do you really think? What's the scenario that might actually work? I know you described part of it. What are those other wedges? Because I know the scientists just kind of accept that as an assumption, this continuing growth, which is not possible. It can't be. I think we can do double.
I think we need to find a way that to have sort of prosperity without growth within our societies, which is going to require more sharing and find ways to make the economic systems that we have. Even liberal economists like Paul Krugman will come out and say, we need growth. We need growth all the time. He's constantly criticizing governments for not promoting growth enough. So we have to get away from, and he's one of the good guys, and we have to get, you know, away from that mindset. And that's not going to be easy at all, because we're basically built like that. We're like these sharks that have to keep swimming to keep breathing, you know. So that's a huge challenge to do that. It's easy to say, but it's going to be very difficult in practice to execute, and very politically unpopular to do it. But I think one of the good news items, just go back to, you mentioned Paul Ehrlich and population. I think one of the best pieces of news we've had over the last few decades is that the population is still increasing. That's because there's a lot of young people who are going to have children. But basically, it's not exploding anymore. We've reached probably the peak number of children in the world is probably higher now than it's ever going to be. So I think that's a good thing. I mean, somehow education and healthcare, and even in the poorest countries, have mostly got the population problem under control. And a recent article by George Monbiot in the Guardian pointed out that the real population problem on the planet is not humans, but cattle. The weight of cattle that we have is right out of control. And we don't have to have that. We can't do anything about the number of people on the planet, but we could reduce the number of domestic livestock that consume a huge amount of food resources and also produce a fair bit of greenhouse gases in their own right. So, you know, there are lots of things we can do with agriculture and our eating habits, which are maybe easier to swallow, if you like, than some of the other changes that we need to make. And maybe we should start making some of those first.
I think there are conscientious people. There's a documentary out now called Cowspiracy that's been recommended. I haven't looked at it. But certainly, as time goes on, if we don't get some sort of control over what's going on, if population continues to grow, I think we're looking at, what is it, supposed to be 10 billion by 2020, I want to say. Maybe that's not quite accurate. But
I think we're looking at about 10 to 11 billion by the end of the century. But a lot of that is just inevitable unless we stop everybody having children. You know, I don't think we can do that, and I don't think we probably want to do that. But, you know, there's a lot of young people in the world, and in most developed countries, the population is not stable or even declining in places like Germany and Russia, and Japan. But so the population is going to grow, especially in Africa. but I don't think there's anything humane that we can do to stop that. So it's something we're going to have to learn to live with and cope with, I believe.
Well, I was thinking about calling Bill Gates because he wants to help so much. I'm sure he could buy enough contraceptive, birth control pills, and he could have little places all over Africa. You know, he wants to have GMO foods. He could have little dispensaries. So I think we could solve that problem. If we really wanted to, we could solve a lot of these problems. And
I think Bill and Melinda Gates probably done more for population control than any other two individuals around. I mean, I think Melinda Gates, that's been a big focus of hers, and they poured a lot of their own money into that. So I'd give them credit. I'd criticize them for a lot of things, but I wouldn't criticize them for not doing anything on population control.
No, I'm just saying, I'm just use them as an example. Actually, there was an article out earlier this week or last week that 10 billionaires, I think 10 or 12 billionaires that are pretty high profile, Mark Zuckerman, Gates and several others, saying they want to help. They want to help with these solutions. Well, that just seems like an easy one. Start right there. Such an easy one, right? So, they've done some good stuff, but I think there's some ulterior motives. There are direct ways you could do things and influence people. We've got, I want to say, 3 more minutes, and I want to give you that time to maybe tell people where they can find more information, or whatever you'd like to do with that time before we're going to be going off there. And you'll hear a little music come on when that's our musical cue to we've got to shut it down. So the mic is yours.
Okay. Well, thanks, Doug, and again, thanks for having me on. The sites I would recommend, you recommended some sites, some websites and so on for information. The one I'd add to that, especially if people want to know what's happening in the Paris talks, is a site called Carbon Brief. And I think if you just type that into a Google bar, you'll find it. They've got a very good series of updates on what this Paris Agreement means, and good quotes from people, and very good sort of unbiased appraisal of that. So I'd recommend Carbon Brief as a place for people to go to find out what's happening about in Paris. And of course, I'd have to recommend Skeptical Science as well. We make big efforts there to try and take peer-reviewed science and make it understandable to people. We don't always succeed, and it's a difficult thing to do. The scientists are not particularly good at turning their science into understandable material for the average person. And the journalists have been getting a lot better lately, but they've had a bad habit of giving too much he said, she said coverage to the people who reject science, the fringe who deny climate science and that kind of thing. So I'd recommend those websites, and I don't know what more to say about what I would recommend particularly, but people should also listen to watch some of the many things on Kevin Anderson puts all his lectures up on YouTube, so you should watch those. They're very easy to follow compared to a lot of scientific talks, and they can be a little bit depressing at times, but it's quite enlightening, really, that we really have to make a lot more effort than we're going to make before we get to stabilize the climate. The brutal fact is that we have to get to zero emissions, or as they're calling them now, what are they calling it? Zero net emissions or whatever.
Or even negative. yeah.
And negative emissions, yeah, if we overshoot our budgets, we have to go back. You know, we overspend on our credit card here. We're going to have to go back and pay it off in the future. So we're setting ourselves up a debt repayment schedule here, and we're saying we can do it, but it remains to be seen if we really can or not. But the mathematics of this is as brutal as balancing your own household budget, and it has to be done.
Well, there's our musical cue. Andy Skous, I want to thank you for being on Unspun, an experiment in truth telling with us today.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Doug.
It's been a pleasure, and you're so well-spoken and handled some of those weird questions that I throw out there so well. So I appreciate that, and I appreciate your work. And I will be putting links up. I'll include that one, Carbon Bridge.
Carbon Brief.
Oh, okay, yeah. Carbon Brief. All right, but I will put that up along with our archives, and we'll have to talk again later when we get a chance.
Okay, we'll do that, Doug. I look forward to it.
Thank you very much,
Goodbye.
Andy. Bye-bye. Well, you've been listening to Unspun, an experiment of truth-telling. Our guest has been Andy Skous, retired Canadian geologist and blogger on skepticalscience.com. I will put links to his articles and the websites that he mentioned, along with a couple others, and on the archives of the show. If you want to find those archives of Unspun, you can go to kkrn.org/shows/unspun. There's about 140 shows there. And I want to wish you a happy holiday season. I'm not going to be live probably until the new year, but I have some of the better Unspun shows that I'll replay the next couple Saturdays. So thanks for listening. Have a great holiday season and a happy new year.